Hi, this is Tamsin Granger.
This is Dan Abuhop.
With Tamsin and Dan Read the Paper, here we are again. It's Sunday, December 2nd.
That's right.
In 2018, the year is winding down.
Right.
And first things first, happy birthday, Bryce. My little brother, Bryce.
Happy birthday, Bryce.
Is celebrating on December 5th.
Okay.
So, happy birthday. I hope he has a good time.
Mm. Yes. And we're sending you this instead of a present, Bryce. But enjoy it. Yes. And anything else before we get going?
I don't think so.
All right. So
what you got?
I should warn more people that the Granger Abuhop, our oldest son, is here. He's here for a big segment coming up soon enough. But in any event, we wanted to start with something about Christmas trees, because this is the season for Christmas trees.
Well, technically, it's the season for Hanukkah.
That's true, too.
It's the first night of Hanukkah.
All right. Good point.
I know that the Grabuha family has been readying itself to make those latkes.
Oh, that's great.
Right, Granger? Granger's in charge of the latkes.
I guess I'm in charge, yeah.
Yes, many years you made the latkes with Nana.
That's true.
That's right.
So
that's
now
true.
You have to
carry on. It's easier now. But in any event, we'll be making the latkes.
And we love latkes.
But
to be honest, we love anything fried.
Yes, but the business, Christmas trees is business first. I used to be in the Christmas tree business. That's how we got to where we are today. The Christmas tree business. We sold Christmas trees. That's how we paid for law school.
Really?
It's true. Sorry to disappoint you. But in any event...
That's a chunk of change.
We sold a lot of trees. But here's something that I'll just ask you guys off the top of your head, see if you know this. What percentage of American households display a Christmas tree? I'm throwing that out there.
43%.
And Granger?
I guess I'll say like 50%.
3/4 of American households display a tree. And now here's the next question. Here's a chance for you to come back, Ranger.
Okay.
What percentage of those people who display a tree, what percentage of that would be artificial trees?
50%.
I'm going to say that it's 1/3 artificial.
Okay. All right. You guys have something to learn. It turns out that 80% of people who have Christmas trees are using artificial trees.
No,
80%,
no.
According, this is the paper
well,
of record. The gray lady, the New York Times. 80%.
It depends who you count.
I would suspect that. Oh. Because, you know, when I took bobbing.
Yes.
Water aquatic exercise, whatever it is. Water aerobics.
This is going to be strong evidence, I can tell. Yes.
All those ladies had artificial trees.
Honey, that's...
They even had artificial trees that were already strung with lights.
Yeah.
And you just take them out of the sack, fluff them up a bit, and bingo.
So a lot of things work that way. But that's what we call anecdotal evidence. The fact of the matter is...
Which is often true. Let's just face it.
The reason that we are in natural tree bias is because natural trees are popular in the northeastern part of the country in California, but it's the rest of the country, the flyover space, as we like to call it, that's into artificial trees. That's why you've got the contrary impression.
Why are they into artificial?
That I can't say. But then,
so why'd you bring it up?
Because the question that's really pressing is, which is better for the environment, artificial trees or real trees? Because when artificial trees have an artificial aspect to it, and you worry about disposal, but real trees, on the other hand, the idea of cutting them down and then having this bare space and replanting, is that the right way to go with the environment? What's the way to go?
Why not?
Okay, so I
chop up my tree and I use the individual branches to cover my delicate perennials.
Yes.
As kind of a mulch thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, then we have the naked trunk. Which can be used for, I don't know, spearfishing or whatever.
All right. So here's the answer. The answer is that if you ask the people who grow trees, they say the best for environment is growing trees. And you ask the people who make artificial trees, they say that, artificial trees. The answer truly is that, first of all, growing trees is good, generally good for the environment. The idea of cutting them down is not a bad thing. These people are in the tree business. They're going to replant the trees. It's not like we're going to, you know, denude the forest. That's not going to happen. They're going to be replanted. It's no problem. As a matter of fact, they have to plant them, as we all know this economically, many years in advance. And the reason the tree prices are so high now is because of economic conditions in 2008 caused people not to plant trees. But that's why they're artificially high.
Well,
the prices will come down. But in any event, the growers...
What about the thing where a lot of people planted Christmas trees at a certain point?
Right.
I would say... You know, late 90s, everybody was planting
trees.
Prices
went down.
I think my brother planted Christmas trees.
Right.
You know.
Prices went down. prices went down. But
so maybe people got disillusioned and stopped planting.
Look, the example. But what's great about Christmas trees, I can tell you from someone in the biz, is that it's a perfect supply and demand situation, and you can see it going in slow motion because it's planting cycles. But in any event, there is disposal, and you shouldn't worry about it. Generally, not so bad for the environment. But the argument for artificial trees works, it turns out, if you keep the tree 20 years. In other words, if someone buys an artificial tree and keeps it 20, 25 years, it really doesn't hurt the environment because there's not a lot of disposal going on. It's the people who buy artificial trees and then cast them aside after a couple of years that it's a problem.
The bobbing ladies, I think, were on a shorter cycle,
sad
to say.
Oh, really?
Because they were always talking the latest innovations.
They're bad bunnies. There's no question about it.
Yeah.
All right. So we'll go for
May I just ask you, did you have a tree in your house growing up?
No, we didn't. It's amazing I was able to sell trees. I'd never seen a tree before. I picked up the business quickly. But in any event, you had a visit to the Barnes Museum yesterday in Philadelphia.
Well, the Barnes Foundation.
Yes.
Which, that's the collection that was put together by Albert Barnes in the early part of the 20th century. And it started out in a purpose-built building that he had in, I'm going to say, Marion, Pennsylvania.
Right.
Not too far from Manayunk. Mm-hmm. Just across the river, and it was supposed to always be there, and then it became, the people who were running it long after his death decided it was not a great location.
It's not.
And so they wanted to move it into Philly.
Right.
And there was a lot of discussion about that.
Right.
You remember all that controversy.
No, I know, but that's behind
that
us.
That it
now,
would be so more accessible to everybody. And eventually they did move into Philly.
So what?
And then, you know, it was funny because Marion, there was always a love-hate relationship, it seemed to be, with the Marion community and the museum. They didn't like the traffic it generated.
Right.
And then when the Barnes Foundation started making noise about moving, then Marion would say, "You can't move. We love you. Yeah. We want you here." But they did move.
But it was a mess. But they're pretty established in Philly now, right?
Yes, it's a lovely place.
And what's
and I should also say that one of the reasons he built his own museum outside, you know, in the outskirts there, was because when he first showed his collection, pieces he was beginning to collect of the Impressionists, of Post-Impressionists, of, you know, New and, you know, Surrealists, of, you know, Soutine, a variety of different styles. His collection was derided and mocked.
Oh, really?
And got a lot of criticism from the somewhat conservative art community in Philadelphia at the time. And he said to those people, "Screw you. You know, I'm going to have my own museum, my own rules, and I don't want any of you fancy pants critics, etc., coming in." And he actually occasionally refused access to various critics, etc.
So was it the same paintings that are now in Philadelphia? You were there?
Absolutely, absolutely.
And you gave it mixed reviews yesterday when I talked to you.
You know what? There's only so much late Renoir you can stomach. And he has cornered the market. but he has a lot of important works by important people. Matisse and Seurat, and there are Picassos, there are Cezannes. There's much wonderful art to see. And actually, it was a field trip organized by my friend Pam Parsigian, and she invited a couple other people, and we wandered around, and I could not shut up. I kept explaining things.
That's right.
Whether people wanted them explained or not.
I've been there.
This is always a liability of going to a museum with me. But it's a beautiful place.
Yeah.
It has parking. It has some restaurants in-house. Uh-huh. And they have changed all their rules. You used to have to sign up for a particular time with a guide who took you around. You could not wander around the museum at your own pace. That has all changed. They have docents available to give you information, but now you can, it's much more like what I would call a normal museum. But
do you recommend it? Are we sending people
there? Oh, it's
there?
Fun.
Okay.
It's lots of fun.
All right. Well, okay.
And it's not huge, so it's manageable.
All right. It's the Barnes Museum in Philadelphia, right?
In Philadelphia, not far from the Rodin Museum.
Yes.
Which Granger was mentioning, which is not far from the Philadelphia Museum of Fine Arts. So lots of fun to be had there.
Yeah. No. Strangely, I
did buy something at the gift shop, in case you're wondering.
No, I wasn't wondering.
I believe in supporting.
Sure. I'm with you. So we have Granger here, in particular, to comment about the NBA, which has been... there's some crazy developments in the season. I'm going to ask Granger about a few of them. Granger needs no preparation here. And I'll just ask him a couple. But then I'm going to grill him. I'm going to start off slow. There's a couple crazy things going on, okay? One is... Well, let me just throw them out. You can just comment on what you think is worth commenting on. One is that the Celtics are not doing that well. Two is that the Lakers are. Three is that the Los Angeles Clippers look like they're pretty good. And four is that the Philadelphia team might get something going with Jimmy Butler. So of those things, and you can comment on more than one, what do you think?
So I think the Celtics are on the gradual upswing. They've won six of their last 10. They're doing pretty well. They've won their last three. Gordon Hayward just had a good game. And if Gordon Hayward can play well, they're going to be okay.
Okay.
And their answer might be to play him less eventually, but they'll be okay. The Lakers were inevitably going to play a little bit better. They've got LeBron. LeBron's great. But the truth is that some of their other players, their other pieces don't make sense. There's a ceiling on that team. They're not going to be a great team. Hmm. They're going to be an okay team.
Are the Clippers for real? Because they have no names.
Clippers are not for real, but they're still having a good season. The West is really, really tightly packed. So the Clippers have a half-game lead for first. There's another team within another half game of that. So, like, if you go down, like, and look at, like, the first seven teams in the NBA are all within 2.5 games of each other. That means that the Clippers have 15 wins and the seventh place team has 13. So the Clippers are going to fall off. They're not that far ahead of anybody.
Okay, how about the 76ers? Did they do the right thing when they got Jimmy Butler? Or does this make them a contender?
Who is Jimmy Butler?
He was a great player for the Chicago Bulls.
Yeah, and then he got in a fight with everyone who worked for them and they traded him away. And then Minnesota acquired him, and he got a fight with everyone there.
But he's
and
a
now
superstar.
They trade him away.
He's a superstar. So the question for this Philly, just to set it up for Granger, is they've been all about draft choices, and now they stepped out and said, let's trade a couple young people and get a real star.
Yeah, the problem is there's not enough shooting on the team. Yeah. So Jimmy gives them a little bit of perimeter defense, a little bit of shooting, last-minute playmaking, which they didn't have before. Ben Simmons is an unconventional player.
Yeah.
So he gives them more of a conventional, like, in the mold of a 2-3 sort of player. But they don't have the shooting that it normally takes to be a winner these days.
But he makes them better.
He definitely makes them better. He's taking away those minutes that before were going to Fultz and Covington. Covington, by the way, is a big success so far for the team they trade him to, the Timberwolves. But Jimmy's an upgrade. But the two teams above them, the Bucks and the Toronto Raptors, look a lot better right now. In a short series, that might be different.
All right.
Can they deal with his personality?
Eventually, they're going to have to. The interesting thing about this season is that Jimmy's a jerk. Everyone knows Jimmy's a jerk. But he's good, and they have 1 year to decide whether or not to sign him for a long-year contract, or for a 5-year contract, 4-year contract, somewhere around there. So what's going to happen is they're going to have to figure out this year if it works. If it works, they'll bring him back. And then they'll probably trade him away again before the whole contract's over, because that's how Jimmy works.
I have to say, I've been hearing on the radio, the public radio.
Yes.
It seems like every year the Phillies are, not the Phillies, but the 76ers are about to be great.
They are about to be great.
But yeah. Why has it not happened? Well, they were in the dumps for a while.
There's a term for this.
Yes.
What?
The process.
That's right.
So the process.
It's called trust the process.
Yeah, so the Philly figured out if they hired a guy who figured out if you lose games, they give you higher draft picks. It started this way of thinking called the process, which is that, like, hey, don't worry about right now. There's always tomorrow, which is not a new thing in sports. Philly's cornered the market on that, but they're running out of future with this team.
Yeah.
Their young guys are all getting older now.
Hence the Jimmy Butler trade.
Yeah.
So they've turned the corner.
They think that their time to
it's
win.
It's now or never.
It's well, now or a long time. This is the beginning of now. So like
okay.
They think that in the next like few years they have to win. And if they don't win then they're gonna start trading people away because it's too much
but
money.
But to that issue that you raised, them, so what the Times says, and here I'm gonna get Granger's reaction to this, he might not agree. The Times says, you know, there's a real limit to how much you can rely on the draft. And here's where it gets controversial. They say, look at 2013 to 15. In 2013, in their view, there's only one superstar that comes out of it, the Greek freak, whose name I can't pronounce. You can.
Giannis Antetokounmpo.
Exactly. In 2000, and said impossibly Oladipo. In 2014, there's Joel Embiid, who happens to be on Philly. But that's it. And in 2015, in their view, there's nobody, maybe Karl Anthony Towns, maybe Porzingis and the Knicks. But he says if that's all you're getting in terms of big superstars from those years as rookies, maybe you don't invest in rookies so much, right?
Well, that's misguided because who cares? They're already done losing. They already have Joel Embiid, so they got the superstar.
Yeah, but
it doesn't matter.
But they're saying you can't really get there. Well, look, it's an issue more for the Nets now than it is for the Sixers. They're going to start getting draft choices. They got young guys. And when they're going to start winning, who knows? The one guy I do like is Jared Allen. I think no one talks about this guy. And, I mean, D'Angelo Russell is good, obviously. But no one talks about Jared Allen. There's a very nice article about Jared Allen in the Times. He's a young kid. He came from Texas. I think he's the real deal. He's a center. He's 7 feet tall. He's got growing to do. And they say he's a very interesting guy. He grew up and his dad played ball, but then he got out of it. Went to work for Dell. He grew up in a family in which they stressed, you know, his father's interest in computing. The kid grew up, built his own computer, never knew anything about AAU basketball, didn't know it was that big, didn't know intercollegiate ball was that big, and suddenly here he is, and he's kind of an oddball guy who didn't grow up basketball crazy. So what do you think of Jared Allen?
I think Jared Allen's okay. He's not a real difference maker. I think, you know, they're hoping someone like Caris LeVert would be more of a difference maker for them.
But he's hurt.
Yeah, he's hurt.
Yeah.
And I think that they've had a lot of Jared Allen type players over like the last 5 years. These guys are like, okay, we're hoping we get something out of him.
Right.
You know, D'Angelo Russell, we're hoping we get something out of him. We'll take a second chance on the kid from Philly. We'll hope we get something out of him.
Jared Allen's a late first round draft choice. So you're hoping to catch lightning in a bottle, right?
Yeah, but the truth is, like, the list you're reading before is what governs the NBA traditionally. You know, LeBron wins, Steph Curry wins. There's only a few people that win.
Okay.
So if they want to, they can win the other way. You could be a team like the Pistons back in the day, like Dallas back in the day, but that's the harder route. I mean, I think they're still hoping to get a big free agent this summer.
That's right. You get a guy at the end, like Jimmy Butler.
Well, they're not going to get anybody this summer, but there's always hope.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Granger. You can see that Granger brings a lot of basketball expertise here. We'll have him again, upping our game.
Thanks.
All right.
Okay. Thank you.
All right.
Happy Hamza. Hanukkah.
Yes, happy Hanukkah. Nina Stibbe, so we haven't heard about her for a long time.
Well, we have a little bit of a food update situation here.
Oh, all right.
Before get into Nina.
What's that?
I need to mention that last week there was a column by your friend and mine, Gabrielle Hamilton.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Telling us quiche is still worth making.
Oh, good.
But you got to make a good quiche.
Well, work
on
that.
And she's right. I mean, there are a zillion quiche recipes out there. And in fact, when I first came to Jersey, I thought quiche was passé.
Yeah.
You know, the early 80s.
It was.
And I got to say, when I had the Cranberry Food Sampler shop, we sold more quiche than we sold of anything else.
Well,
nobody told Jersey.
I was just going to say, you were in the boonies. They didn't know. What's
everybody still loved quiche.
Here's something you might tuck away. What's passé in New York is big.
No, but here's
in Central New Jersey.
Even going forward,
yeah,
you know, when I make a quiche for a party, it's always the hit.
Well, you know, let me just say this.
And people always say, you know, I never thought I liked quiche, this is delicious.
Well, it's possible you make a good quiche.
Yes, because not unlike Gabrielle Hamilton, I use real ingredients.
Yeah.
You know, there are a million quiche recipes out there using skim milk.
Oh, my God. Oh, my.
Or all kinds of weird things.
Stop right there.
Heavy cream, baby. Heavy cream.
Yes.
Real eggs.
Heavy cream and everything.
Whole eggs. You know, not an overabundance of cheese. And, you know, whatever leftovers you got in the fridge, throw them in. You can make a great quiche. So there's that. I'm still making quiche, and everybody's still loving it. Yes, Gabrielle, you're right.
Okay.
Also, In the Wall Street Journal, there was some advice about gifts one could give.
I saw that.
And I know you were underwhelmed.
Underwhelmed.
But I did see they did have a little thing about giving people cast iron skillets.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
I feel like that comes up every year.
Yeah.
That the one thing you need is a great cast iron skillet.
Mm-hmm.
So this year's offering is from fieldcompany.com. Okay. So I don't need a cast iron skillet, but I looked at the website anyway, fieldcompany.com, and there's a terrific article about restaurants with live fire, open fire cooking, all over the U.S., mm-hmm. the best restaurants offering open fire cooking, grilling, etc. And it's a really great resource. And there are these restaurants everywhere, not just California and Portland. I mean, you knew Portland was going to have offerings
mm-hmm.
in that, but also in the U.S., Atlanta, Nashville, Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
So fieldcompany.com, look at their ranking of those restaurants. That's a fun article. Also, fun article on travel. 36 hours in Rome in the winter, which I got to say, it is fun to go to Rome in the winter. You and I have done that.
This was in the Journal?
Yeah. No, this was in the New York Times okay. travel section.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, by David Laskin.
Oh, our buddy.
Who I knew years ago because he...
he's the husband of a woman who was an associate at Everwise.
Right. Yeah. And he has some great suggestions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's great to go... Rome doesn't get that cold. So it's very manageable in the winter.
Mm-hmm.
And this article is actually telling you fun places to go that aren't on the touristic mainstream.
Yes.
But the touristic mainstream stuff, like the Sistine Chapel, etc., is actually fun in the winter because there are many fewer people yes. on the line.
Well, we knew David okay. when he was a struggling writer. And the big job he landed was the Esquire's Guide to Making Drinks. Which
Really?
I think he aced
I had forgotten one. That.
Yeah. That's how we got into the business. Yeah.
But so he has a bunch of great suggestions and a lot of new fun food places to go. And actually a suggestion that you go see the Fontanone, the big fountain, which we have been to
mm-hmm.
and which is in the opening sequence of that wonderful movie by Paolo Sorrentino, La Grande Balazza.
Ah.
And that is a wonderful... You remember that opening?
The Great Beauty?
And the Great Beauty
yes.
and the beautiful music.
For the English-speaking people listening, yes. Yeah, that was a great film.
That's a great film, although I did encourage people at yoga to go see it. And... one lady in particular came running up to me to say, that is the worst money I ever spent in my
that
life.
That happened to us, too.
So my mouth is yeah. shut in yoga from now on,
yeah.
because I thought that was one of the best movies right. I ever saw. But back to food.
Really? Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Ruth Reichel
yeah.
does a review of a book by Nina Stibbe
yeah.
called An Almost Perfect Christmas. And, you know, Nina Stibbe is British.
And what's that have to do with food? But Nina Stibbe is like a regular writer. She's not a food writer.
Well, she does give, I mean, you know, she tells about Christmas celebrations, which include food.
Okay.
And I guess it opens up, Reichel opens up the review with talking about trying to defrost a freezer refrigerator with her mother, and apparently Nina writes about the same thing.
Ooh.
Other than
Ooh.
That,
Ooh.
Reichel feels that a lot of the book is pretty impenetrable because it needs to be translated from the English.
Ah, I see.
So that's funny to me. That's funny that, and you do realize this every once in a while, that there's this huge cultural disconnect between the English and the American.
About Christmas or about
yeah,
food?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, well, we've noticed that before in terms of culture.
Yeah.
We have gone to British plays and not understood a word.
Yeah.
And not understood any of the references, not gotten the jokes. Mm-hmm. And this is part of what's going on in this book. Nonetheless, Reichel seems to basically enjoy it. But, you know, you got to be ready for it. So if you're an Anglophile, or maybe if you're an Angle, this would be a good book for you about Christmas. An Almost Perfect Christmas is an introduction to Nina's England, a place filled with people named Bunny Wedgwood and sisters called Vic. It is an England where everyone loves dogs and is slightly, delightfully batty.
Yeah.
It's an England that makes you long to spend your Christmas there.
Yeah, I mean, I would say you're going to read this book.
I might. She also mentions that Stibbe gives a terrific Christmas playlist.
Okay.
And does remark that Nina insists that Slade's Merry Xmas Everybody is the best Christmas song ever written.
Okay.
And she notes, have you heard of it? Neither had
Reichel. Yeah.
So, worth considering.
All right. So, the book I have here is a book about the Weavers, the folk singing group. This is in the Times big book section. And the book is called Wasn't That a Time? The Weavers, the Blacklist, and the Battle for the Soul of America, which is somewhat grandiose. But what's interesting is, you know, we listen to the Weavers. The Weavers are a great folk singing group. But I didn't know these details. I had some sense of it. And the story is quite interesting. So the Weavers, of course, was the group with Pete Seeger. Pete Seeger became famous.
Do you know the other people?
I do. They're buried here. Ronnie Gilbert, Lee Hayes, and Fred Hellerman. There you go. But what's interesting is that in 1949, they got together, and they were, you know, performed at some political or labor gatherings. Then they got a regular gig at the Village Vanguard. So they were that exactly what you'd expect. Downtown performers, got paid very little. They got a weekly payment of $200 split equally among the four of them, plus all the hamburgers they could eat. Then they got a real manager, a fellow named Harold Leventhal, who had gone to manage Joan Baez and Mary Travers from Peter, Paul, and Mary.
Right.
Who both admired the Weavers. And he got them a record contract of all things, and they became big in, in 49.
So what were their big songs?
Their big songs were Good Night, Irene.
Which is funny. That was a big song.
Right? But it was. Sana, 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 which I think.
Right.
And Whim Away.
Whim Away, which later becomes.
Which later becomes a song called The Lion Sleeps Tonight by The Tokens, which was not released until 1961.
I always found that tremendously confusing because we would listen to Pete Seeger singing that. And I would say, but isn't that a rock song?
Right. But here's what, yes, people, look it up. We're not going to sing, but you know the song. Okay, you know the song, The Lion Sleeps, in the jungle, the mighty jungle, The Lion Sleeps Tonight. But in any event.
I know you want to sing.
I do, but you don't want to hear it. So, but here's what's interesting. As you can tell by those songs, they didn't make it big with the political songs so much. Even though when they got together live, they started with If I Had a Hammer and that kind of stuff. Once they got bigger, during their short burst, they stopped singing If I Had a Hammer. And they concentrated more on Goodnight Irene.
So If I Had a Hammer was their song originally?
No, I think it's a...
Because we all sang that.
No, I think it's a Woody Guthrie song.
We all sang
song.
That.
I think it's a Woody Guthrie song.
Every week. It's a senior fellowship
but
group.
But you've
got to
slow down. You're talking about 1965. Times had changed. All right? So now we're talking about the 50s. Here's what happens if you sing If I Had a Hammer in the 50s.
Yeah.
You get blacklisted. And that's what happened to them. By 1952, they couldn't work.
Wow.
Because they were blacklisted. Now, it wasn't because they sang If I Had a Hammer. That didn't help. It'd be because Pete Seeger, when he got in front of the House of Un-American Activities, wouldn't answer questions because of the First Amendment. You're saying to yourself, yeah, First Amendment. No. Most people said Fifth Amendment. Didn't want to incriminate myself. He said First Amendment. I don't have to answer your questions. Blacklisted. Okay? And it wasn't until... Lee Hayes got them together for that Carnegie Hall concert. That was their comeback. And the reason I know you know about the Carnegie Hall concert...
Which was when?
Which was, I think, about 1960. The reason I know about Carnegie Hall, and you do too, is because that was the subject of the movie we saw. The documentary was about that concert. And that movie, and this is what I'm recommending here, more than the book, frankly. a movie called The Weavers Wasn't That a Time. And that is a great documentary.
Well, we saw that in the late 70s. Yeah. When did that come out?
Yeah, late 70s, early 80s, sure.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Wasn't that a great movie?
That was a great movie. I do remember seeing it very clearly.
Yes.
I even remember going out to a village, like, coffee shop, coffee house afterwards. But we loved the Weavers.
We loved the Weavers.
We played the Weavers a lot.
And the kids grew up listening to the Weavers. And what's interesting to me is my parents grew up playing the Weavers. And I always wonder, I don't wonder really, but I sort of wonder, my parents were a little left-leaning. Honestly, okay? And if my parents were listening to the Weavers in the 50s, they would have had to be left-leaning. And my parents did work for Henry Wallace in the 1948 presidential election, which was someone who came in third behind Dewey and Truman. So, we never talked too much about that aspect of politics, but I think they were open to it.
Why, you were afraid they would get blacklisted?
No, it's just that my parents were kind of, you know, liberal hip, I guess, you know, in the 50s. I mean, to be out there in Long Island listening to the Weavers, I don't know if everybody listens to
Weavers. Well, I know your brother Bob.
Well, my brother
Bob was a great fan of Pete Seeger.
But yes, he became friendly with Pete Seeger later in Pete Seeger's life, but before he died, up there by the Hudson. But in any event, so speaking about...
So Wasn't That a Time?
Wasn't That a Time.
The story of the Weavers, it's really the story of that concert, getting back together for that concert.
Yes, but it's a great... film. So there's a, speaking of film, there was Bernardo Bertolucci died. And
Italian filmmaker.
The Italian filmmaker. And there was a very interesting piece in a journal about him. Bertolucci is known as much as anything for, well, what was that movie? The movie with Marlon Brando. Which was
Last Tango.
Last Tango in Paris, which was what we used to call a dirty movie. And you could see it, though. You could see Last Tango in Paris. We respected it because it was a Bertolucci movie. It was a real movie. And it got distributed, and Brando did some sort of...
Well, you saw that movie.
And I did see it, yes.
I remember you standing in line to see that movie. I did not see that movie.
Well, this is
I'm not that kind of girl.
I was in Saratoga, New York with some friends. We saw the movie. I don't remember it too well. But it was considered pretty out there and certainly controversial. And Marlon Brando. I mean, Marlon Brando. It wasn't like, you know, you had some pornographic actors or actresses, really. But in any event, that's really, is that not what makes the most impression on me in terms of Bertolucci? And I think it's fair. The Times wrote a really good article. Not the Times, the Journal. And I want to throw this in front of you to get your reaction. Because the way they describe Bertolucci, they said he was a descendant of the great Italian visual artists of the Renaissance. With his lush, sumptuous, expressionistic colors, Bertolucci was the last great Italian painter. How's that? And the reason that resonates with me even a little bit, and it does resonate with me a little bit, is because of a different movie, a movie called The Last Emperor, which came out in 1981, which was wildly acclaimed, which won Best Picture, which won like 9 Academy Awards, and was a great film. We did see that one together. And, you know, I struck last week, Zeke said something about he saw some movie last week. I guess it was the Harry Potter type movie. He said it was okay. He didn't remember anything 15 minutes later. I remember The Last Emperor, even though I saw it in 1981. And what I remember about it was the
visual
scenes,
experience.
The visual experience.
Right.
And you might even say... the color. It was a staggering film, and it was a great film. What the journal says is, in The Last Emperor, Bertolucci portrays both the repressive Chinese monarchy and the oppressive Cultural Revolution with a vividness of color that almost assaults you with its breathtaking beauty. And it's a story of an emperor who became emperor in about 1920, 1925, and he's an emperor of China, and he goes through the whole experience of China, and by the end of the movie, he's a gardener who was sort of re-educated in the Maoist Revolution. But it's an epic sweep. It was 3 hours and 40 minutes long. And yet it holds you in. The way the journal finishes the article, it says, "Wine is sunlight held together by water," said Galileo. In Bertolucci's films, morality is a story that is held together by infinite gradations of articulate color. That quality is what made his best films neither too much nor certainly too little, but the timeless works of cinematic art that they are. Again, another recommendation. I would the last.
But I don't think it's just a visual thing. I think
it's
the,
not just
the
that.
Story.
I think that's true.
Keeps you there.
Well,
because I mean, we can talk a bit about this till the cows come home. We're talking about La Grande Bellezza.
Yeah.
You know,
beautiful movie. Which
beautiful
been
movie, but probably not as compelling in terms of narrative.
But still as compelling. I would put it up there with that movie. I mean,
right. So he wasn't the last great.
He wasn't the last
Italian artist.
So you might say that the Italian artist who made The Great Beauty was next in the line, basically. Or
right, so there's always going to be an Italian painting beautiful pictures, whether it's in a church or on a screen.
Well, look, the point isn't that the line ends. The point is that there is some relationship between these visual presentations. And I think that's fair, and you might look to the Italian directors for that. I will say also, finally, that I did see the Black Panther movie last night. And I know you saw it on an airplane.
I saw it on an airplane, and I watched some of it with you guys as you were watching it on TV.
Right.
And it is fun. It is good.
Yes. It is. It's more than...
Love the costumes.
Yeah. In a movie, it is very good. And it's not like I love all Marvel movies, but in a year in which there's not an obvious candidate for Best Picture, if that picture got nominated for Best Picture, and even if it won, it wouldn't shock me. It wouldn't disturb me. I mean, it's a good movie.
Tells
a good story. Very
great
compelling.
Great characters.
Yeah.
Beautiful in many ways.
Yeah.
And you know... Fun things like the mechanical rhinos, yes. Just love them.
I didn't go for the rhinos, but I like the movie. You're a rhino lover, but I thought it was a good movie. I would recommend that too. But okay, so again, then you had something about the advertising industry.
You know, I gotta say, it seems to me,
yeah,
every few months there is an obituary about a woman who people say really captured the female character in The Mad Men, you know,
right.
And maybe was, you know, even the basis
right.
for the female character in Mad Men. And so I almost wasn't going to read this obituary. It's of Jane Maas, who was in a key member of Ogilvy Mather. And actually, this was pretty interesting. I enjoyed reading this. Apparently she made famous the strategy of husband pleasing. Okay, that it was easy to sell coffee if you showed a woman who was serving the coffee to her husband and he wanted a second cup.
Right.
Okay, so this becomes an anathema to feminists,
mm-hmm.
etc. But Jane never backs away. This is her strategy. It works. It sells.
Yeah.
And so she sticks with that. And she, you know, kind of an odd, interesting duck, standing 5'0". She described herself as tough, little but tough, and relentlessly cheerful. She never claimed to have it all. She said, "My priorities are job first, husband second, children third. It's the only way for a woman to survive in the advertising business." They do mention that she was lucky enough to get herself a nanny and housekeeper who stayed with them for 32 years.
It's a long time.
That was really key to the success. I mean, any businesswoman you talk to often says, what I really need is a good wife.
Yeah.
And sounds like this housekeeper was the wife, the person who, kept the family running while Jane was running business. And she makes a lot of interesting remarks about the complicated place that advertising business was in those years. She had to fight off advances by various bosses. And she says, you know, it wasn't even clear how you were supposed to deal with it. There was certainly no one in human resource who was going to respond to your complaints. And who was she going to tell? She couldn't tell her husband. She said he would come to the office with a gun. There's that. One of her most interesting clients, I would say, had to be Leona Helmsley.
Yeah, she has a great line about
the
that.
New York hotel owner who became known as the Queen of Mean. And she was a tough client. And actually, Helmsley encourages Jane Moss to go off on her own. But their relationship ends after about 7 months. And Helmsley convinces her to get a new hairstylist, stop wearing pantsuits, and wear sexier bras for some reason. And after that's all over, Moss remarks, "Don't believe everything you've read about Leona. She was worse than that." She strikes me as a pretty interesting person with a complex history, and I enjoyed reading about her.
Well, that is interesting. I remember also reading about the crazy climate in Ogilvie Manor. You know, the crazy cruises, the overt sexual activities. It's a kind of a wild ride.
At the office party kind of thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We'll end on this, because this comes from totally out of left field. The headline is, "Britain may honor a pioneer in soft ice cream, the Iron Lady." What is going on there? What's going on is that Britain is trying to figure out who to put on a 50-pound note. They have a spot open, and they're looking to put a woman on a 50-pound note. But they don't want to put a political figure. They're looking to put on a scientist. And they have some female nominees. Ada Lovelace, a mathematician who was the first computer programmer in 1843, they say.
Daughter of Lord Byron.
Right. We've talked about her. Dorothy Hodgkin, someone who pioneered mapping molecular structures. They also have some male people who are being pressed. Alan Turing, who is the subject of the movie we saw, the mathematician, played a key role in modern computing. Alexander Fleming discovered penicillin, not a small thing. But now a case is being made for Margaret Thatcher as a scientist. Margaret Thatcher as a scientist.
As a scientist.
That's right.
Did she invent soft ice cream?
Her scientific contribution was she famously worked on the research team which helped invent soft serve. And I'm going, what? Really?
I would have thought soft serve was always with us.
No.
That had to be invented?
The claim was that she helped invent soft serve ice cream while at a company called J. Lyons. She's described as, quote, part of the team that invented Mr. Whippy, the major British soft serve brand. And on that basis, she's putting foot forward as a scientist who might be on the 50-pound note.
Mr. Whippy?
That's right.
That is a great name.
So, if she came up with a name, she might even have a stronger claim. But they're saying, look, it's...
The children in England run down the street saying, Mr. Whippy's coming, Mr. Whippy's coming.
That's right. They run or they jog or whatever they can do in the UK. But the point is that, you know, she can't get on a bill as a on a note. As a politician, they like to wait a long time for that. They've got the Duke of Wellington got on recently. I mean, Winston Churchill just got on, but that's still going somewhere. Actually, she's got to wait for that.
But won't people misunderstand? Will they have to put something on the currency?
I don't know how this is going
to go. To make this clear, this is not Margaret Thatcher, Prime Minister. This is Margaret Thatcher, female scientist.
Yes, and I have her with an ice cream cone in her hand. I don't know.
Turns out women can do it all.
Apparently. So there you go. There's, where there's a will, there's a way.
And all right, we hope to leave you with a little bit of the best Christmas song ever.
According to Nina Stibbe.
According to Nina Stibbe.
And it is Merry Xmas,
Everybody.
By Slade.
See you next week. This is Tamsin Granger.
Dan Abuhoff. Tamsin, Dan, read the paper.
Constantly. Are you happy?